Today on Maine Calling, automotive news and advice. If you're in the market for a new vehicle, there is a lot to consider right now. Gas prices are surging again, so you may be considering an EV. But the federal credits expired in October. The used EV market is super hot, and there are deals out there, but there are also models you'll want to avoid. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we check in with a panel of automotive experts to talk EVs and much more. What do they think of the new Slate truck? Are inexpensive Chinese autos ever going to be sold here in the U.S.? Do they have simple tips for saving gas? We'll also check in with political reporter Steve Missler about the Democratic nominating process for the U.S. Senate race. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Gas prices are again averaging more than $4 a gallon. The price of a new car is averaging $50,000, and there are no longer federal rebates for electric vehicles. So what to do if you need a new car? What's on the horizon? Today, we're going to check in with our favorite automotive experts for advice. With us for the hour, John Paul, Senior Manager of Public Affairs and Traffic Safety at AAA Northeast. He is also known as the Car Doctor. Maybe you've heard his podcast. Micheline Mickey Maynard is a Boston Globe contributing columnist and author of The End of Detroit. She also publishes Intersection, Everything That Moves on Substack. And Craig Fitzgerald is automotive editor for DCI Marketing and is former president of the New England Motor Press Association. Mickey and John, welcome back to Maine Calling. And Craig, welcome to Maine Calling. As always, we invite you to join the conversation. Are you considering an EV? Do you have questions about car repairs, financing? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Before we talk cars, though, we have to talk politics. And joining us, Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent, Steve Missler, here to update us on the latest news about the Democratic Senate race. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Oh, happy to be with you.
Wow, what a weekend. Bring us up to speed. We went into this weekend thinking that the Democrats were holding county meetings to choose delegates for a convention next weekend. And somehow, Troy Jackson went from being one of the 12 candidates to being the presumptive nominee. What happened?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think what happened was they held these county caucuses over the weekend in all 16 counties. And those caucuses were designed to choose delegates that will be used to ultimately vote for the nominee at the nomination convention this Saturday. But what happened is that several of the candidates, especially the ones that were just coming off of gubernatorial campaigns, including Troy Jackson, Shenna Bellows, and Nirav Shah, basically started to try to gather delegates before the caucuses. And Troy Jackson did that most effectively. He ended up winning, I think, something like almost close to all of the 500 delegates that were in play. I mean, these are delegates that are not bound to him, but have already expressed support for him. And so he's technically not the nominee yet, but he effectively is because of this delegate support, this pledge support from the 500 or close to 500 delegates that were in play over the weekend. So, you know, it likely takes a lot of suspense out of the nomination convention on Saturday, because a lot of his opponents or rivals in the race have dropped out. Nirav Shah dropped out. Shenna Bellows dropped out. Jordan Wood dropped out as well. And Dan Kleben, the owner of Main Beer Company, also dropped out after basically just seeing the writing on the wall from these caucus meetings.
How did Jackson's campaign mobilize so quickly and so well? Did they have help?
That's a great question. I think what appears to have happened is that he actually inherited Graham Plattner's volunteer base, which was 15,000 strong. And so what happened was a lot of Graham Plattner's volunteers ran as delegates and pledged their support to Troy Jackson. And so he picked up a lot of those folks. And in addition to that, he also picked up people who were running as delegates that were associated with the Maine labor movement in the state. And so a lot of those folks expressed support for Jackson because Jackson has been a longtime ally of labor unions in the state. And so he had almost like built-in advantages in some ways because his platform is very, very much like Graham Plattner's platform. It's a Bernie Sanders type platform. And so there was just like this transference of all this support that went to him almost by virtue of what he was running on. And so, then the delegate elections. So it's really interesting, but you can almost see it coming. You know what I mean? In some ways, I think the big question going into the last weekend was whether or not that volunteer base would migrate to Troy Jackson, but it appears that it has.
I know that the last thing you want to do is make a prediction. So I'm not going to ask you what's going to happen in November, but I'm going to ask you what are the important factors to consider when we think about what the chances are of Troy Jackson defeating Susan Collins or Susan Collins holding on to yet another term?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, honestly, it's going to be very difficult. I mean, I know the fundamentals of the race, which are basically that this is a midterm election that should favor Democrats just by virtue of the president's unpopularity and the fact that Democrats are highly mobilized to take recontrol of Congress to blunt his power. So those fundamentals are in play all over the country, including in this state. So that's in Jackson's favor. The downside for him is that he's facing Susan Collins, who's always been an electoral behemoth in this state, has won tough elections in the past, including in 2020 when the fundamentals were similar, but not quite the same way, not a total analog. And you know, the other piece I think will be difficult too is Jackson. He has all of the progressive and working class bona fides that Graham Plattner was claiming before he dropped out of the race. But he doesn't have the same he's not the same kind of communicator. And I think that's one of the reasons why Plattner drew a lot of support before, you know, ultimately bowing out, and why there was such a movement behind him. Jackson is a different style of communicator. And I think that will be a challenge for him, especially for those who are unfamiliar with his accent, unfamiliar with the way he talks. And I think, you know, I think that may be a more of a factor in the race than people would probably be willing to admit. But, you know, again, it'll be difficult. It would be difficult for no matter which Democrat was chosen, to be quite frank with you. I don't think it matters. I think, you know, Susan Collins is battle tested in this state and will be difficult to beat. It just doesn't matter. But Troy Jackson will have a difficult time as well, just because also he hasn't been running for the past year. You know what I mean? This has all come in the last couple of weeks, and he's gone from, you know, seeking the gubernatorial seat to running for the U.S. Senate. It's fundamentally different kind of race, fundamentally different level of media attention and media scrutiny as well.
So unless there's another really big surprise in the next week or so, we likely have two U.S. Senate candidates from Aroostook County.
That's exactly right. Yeah. In fact, when I talked to Troy Jackson yesterday in Sanford at one of the county caucuses, he brought that up. You know, they're both from Aroostook County. He frames that relationship as I think the same way he'll frame the race, which is that Susan Collins comes from a prominent family in Aroostook County, and he came from nothing. That's the way he talked about it yesterday. And I think he'll probably talk about that a lot in the campaign going forward.
Well, Steve, We look forward to talking to you a lot more about this. Steve Missler, Maine Public's Chief Politics and Government Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're going to turn to today's topic, cars. Welcome to all of you. And Mickey, I'm going to start with you because you wrote a column in the Boston Globe recently that was really interesting. It was talking about, and this is something we've talked about in Maine Calling before, how despite the fact that a few years ago, American automakers were really focusing on EVs, electrical vehicles, it didn't seem as though the public was ready to buy them. So one by one, they were falling off. But now gas is $4 a gallon, and I'm going to just sort of hand it to you now. Where does that leave American automakers?
So thank you so much for having me. The dichotomy of what's going on is that the Detroit car makers over the last 5 years or so really dove into EVs and gave the impression that, you know, EVs were the future. And not only did they announce plans to build EVs, but they also invested heavily in battery factories. So at this point, a couple of those battery ventures have been abandoned. Some of the EVs they're planning to build have been abandoned. Ford took a massive charge against its earnings because it, you know, guessed wrong, or at least it couldn't get its consumers to buy EVs in the large quantities that it was hoping for. So right now, President Trump essentially wiped out all of the incentives for EV purchases, including the $7,500 tax credit that actually prompted some people to go into EVs. So you would think that the car makers would have been in a great position until gas prices went up. And so now all the Detroit companies are kind of scrambling. They're trying to focus on people on, hey, we will have EVs coming. But in the meantime, we've had some small companies that are very interesting to a lot of us that are emerging into the market. And one of them is Slate, which is not owned by a small company. It's an Amazon Jeff Bezos venture, and they're about to introduce their first EV truck at the end of the year. And then Rivian, which is kind of a darling among people that follow the EV market, they have introduced the R2 SUVs, and it's gotten rave reviews from the people that follow EVs. I have not yet driven one, but I know that those folks are very enthusiastic about it.
Well, Craig, you've been nodding all along. Are you one of those very enthusiastic about the Rivian and the Slate truck?
I'm hugely enthusiastic about the Slate because it fills a huge hole in the marketplace right now for a relatively inexpensive vehicle. You know, the starting price was originally kind of pegged at $19,995. That's gone up now that the tax credit has gone away to about 27 grand, but that's still significantly cheaper than even something like the Ford Maverick, which when you actually get down to it, ends up being about 29 grand. It's a really interesting vehicle because there's no options on it. Well, I shouldn't say that. There's no standard content on it. If you want a radio in it, they give you a Bluetooth speaker. If you want stripes on it, you can order stripes for it. It's a really kind of an interesting way to sell a vehicle, and I'm very excited about it. And then Rivian, you know, they're kind of proven at this point. They sell quite a number of vehicles in New England. And we've been waiting for what the next, you know, iteration of that is. And the R2 and the R3X, like those are interesting vehicles to me. One of them is significantly smaller, almost the size of a Subaru Crosstrek. So those are going to be interesting for a lot of people, because I think what happened was initially with the EV market, it was like we were all looking at Tesla and they were selling $100,000 vehicles or $80,000 vehicles. So the entire industry thought, let's just do that. And now what they're focused on is a much more affordable vehicle, which is very interesting to me.
Yeah. So to jump in on the Slate, for people who don't know, this is a pickup truck. And it is bare bones, and you add to it what you want. If you want to make it into an SUV, you can do that. If you want a truck with a cab, or you know, four people could sit, you can do that. And it, they ask people to put down $50 deposits, which I did just out of curiosity. I'm not ready to get one yet, But they got 180,000 people to put down these $50 deposits. And now we can move on and put down a $500 deposit. And even if they got half of those people, or even if they got 50,000 people to put down the deposit, that's going to be a significant vehicle in the EV market. It has the potential to be.
Every time we do this program, there are so many people who are in the market kind of for a car. Maybe they're at that place where their car is needing repairs and they are trying to figure out when they need a new car. And one thing that's interesting to me, and I'm going to turn to you, John, is all of you get to test drive cars. John, you are always telling me about what you've test driven, but you're often not in the market for a personal car, but John, you have bought a car recently. Tell me how you thought that through with all the knowledge that you have about what's out there, what's coming, what your needs are in New England, etc.
Like everyone else, I didn't take my own advice. Most, it was sort of interesting. For people who have listened to the program before, I spend half my time in New England and half my time in Florida. And we had a car up here in New England that was old and rusty, and it was time to replace it. We had a car in Florida that was 11 years old. But had pretty low mileage. So I drove that car back up to New England and left my little SUV in Florida. So I wanted something kind of in an SUV category, but I had a very specific budget in mind. I wanted to stay, I didn't want to go over $30,000. And like Mickey said, the looking at some of the pricing of new cars, and like you said, Jennifer, the new car prices are, in the $50,000 range. And I'm just not prepared to spend that for a car. So I ended up buying a Hyundai Tucson, sort of the base model, all-wheel drive. It has every advanced safety feature that can drive you crazy. Has lane departure warning and tells you when to take a break if you don't have your eyes on the road. But it also gets reasonably good gas mileage. The difference between the hybrid and that, and I encourage people to buy hybrids if they're trying to, maximize fuel economy. But I looked at the price that I wanted to spend versus the price of the hybrid. And in the kind of driving that I do today, it's going to take me 12 years to pay back that difference in cost in fuel savings. So I'm like, I'm going to spend 30,000. I'll get the car. It does everything I need it to do. My first trip in it averaged 36 miles to the gallon. So pretty fuel efficient. It does everything I need to do. It works just fine. And again, would I, is that the car I'd recommend for a lot of people? It works out fine. And somebody said to me, why didn't you buy the hybrid? You could have bought the hybrid. One key reason, the hybrid doesn't come with a spare tire. And I like having a spare tire. As crazy as it is, I like having a spare tire.
How many
Tire
times have you
inflation
lost
can't
the tire?
sustain.
How many
Do you
times has
blow a
that
lot
happened
of
to you?
tires?
It's happened. It's happened enough where I wouldn't want to be stranded where I've been stranded. So, and I carry an air compressor with me, a tire plug kit. So if I can actually, if it's a nail and the tire isn't damaged, I can at least put a plug in it, air it up, and get on the road again. But I have this fear of hitting something and blowing out a sidewall and being stuck, and I hate that.
I really appreciate your honesty, John, because I think that we all have a different thing that's important to us when we're shopping for a car. For some people, maybe they don't want to admit that they want something that's cute. Other people may not really admit that they want people to think they're cool. Or some people, like you said, want to have a spare tire. I know somebody who wants to have a stick shift, which is fine, harder and harder to come by. But, you all give us terrific advice, but it is important to acknowledge that we are all different and we don't all want the same thing.
And Craig knows I'm just cheap.
I was going to say that, that is Yankee advice if I've ever heard it, is you want to listen to John Paul because like he's the thriftiest man I know. So.
Well, I, as the daughter and granddaughter of New England, I have to chime in to say that the car I owned before this one, I had for, I think, 11 years, and this one is now 10 years old. And I'm a hybrid driver. And this has been a year when hybrids have really taken off. It's something like one out of five vehicles sold so far this year is a hybrid. And part of it is because Toyota has gone all hybrid with a couple of its vehicles, with the Camry sedan, which people might own, and with the RAV4 small sport utility, which is actually the number one selling vehicle behind the Ford F-Series and the Chevrolet Silverado. And those are big pickup
And
trucks.
I believe
So,
it's number one in Maine.
oh, really? Well, I'm not surprised. My brother had a RAV and loved it, and now has the one step up, the Highlander.
Yeah,
I'm
we
driving
do
a
have to go to a
Sienna.
break pretty soon, but I've got to ask you, John, you bought a new car, right? Not a used car.
Yes, I bought a new car.
And what was your thinking behind that?
All the used cars I looked at, and I wanted something with lower mileage, and most of them were previously, Hertz Avis rent-a-cars. And the ones with low mileage all had been involved in some kind of crash. When you do the Carfax or one of those things, it's like, oh, this one only has 3,000 miles on it. Yeah, because it was hit from behind and, has some history. The ones that the rental car companies generally, if the cars are in decent shape, they're keeping them for 30, 40, 50,000 miles. One of the reasons I bought a Hyundai is 5-year, 60,000 mile bumper to bumper warranty, 10-year, 100,000 mile drivetrain warranty. I wanted to maximize as much warranty. There wasn't a lot of difference in price between a late model used and new, so I went with new.
All right. Well, we do need to take a quick break. Your questions. This is Maine Calling when we come back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, the latest news from the world of cars, trucks, and SUVs. My guest, Mickey Maynard, who's Boston Globe contributing columnist, author of the book The End of Detroit, and she publishes Intersection, Everything That Moves on Substack. John Paul is a senior manager of public affairs and traffic safety at AAA Northeast. He's also the host of the Car Doctor radio podcast. And Craig Fitzgerald is the automotive editor for DCI Marketing. You can share your comments and questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on our Facebook page or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Calls already coming in. But before we go to this, I want to circle back to talking about EVs and talking about saving money. And Mickey, I want to ask you, so much has been made about this new generation of EVs that are from Asia, specifically China, and how inexpensive they are, how great they are. Will Americans be able to buy those anytime soon?
Well, we won't be able to buy them anytime soon in the United States, but they are going to be available in Canada. And I think the first ones might already be arriving. Canada reached a trade agreement with China to allow 48,000 Chinese-built EVs into the country, and then that'll max out at about 78,000. And I think all of us are tempted to just cross the border and go find a dealership where they'll be sold to take a look at them. There's been pushback, obviously, from the union that represents the Canadian auto workers, because they're very afraid that these vehicles will take sales away from the other companies and then eventually jobs away. But I'm very curious to see them. I've only seen them at auto shows. I haven't had a chance to actually drive one. The thing to remember about the Chinese market is that it's vast and it's very diverse, and you have a situation there where you can actually kind of rent a battery. So if you only use your car for a few months for city driving and you don't need that much of a charge, you can just get one size of a battery, and then if you start to do more long distance driving, you can take it in and swap in a new battery. And it's the kind of thing that we can't really fathom yet, but which could become more familiar if things like that go that way up in Canada.
So here's the interesting thing for Maine too, is like we see a lot of Canadian tourists, and I'll take you back to about 1984, the very first Hyundai I ever saw, maybe it was earlier than that, 83, was a Canadian tourist who would come down for the summer, and I was in Ogunquit and happened to
Oh.
see, happened to see this car. I was like, I thought it said Honda on it when I looked at it at first, and I was like, no, that's Hyundai. I don't even know what that is. So we're going to start to see these things, maybe not faster than anybody else, but we will definitely see them, in the next few years. And that, I think, is going to spur some interest. The idea that you're going to be able to buy one from somebody, it's probably not going to happen, at least for the next several years. But I don't think there's any way to kind of hold that off forever. One way or another, we're going to get these things. So, whether it's a captive import situation where a Ford Motor Company or somebody, labels a Chinese vehicle as their own, that may happen at first, just the way they did with Japanese pickup trucks, early on. That's the way you're going to start to see these things.
John.
Craig and I met an interesting, I'll call him a character.
Oh, he was a character.
Yeah, a guy by the name of Mark Dweck, who is the CEO and founder of a company called Wink. And it's basically a Chinese car company, but it's a low-speed electric vehicle. So it's really designed for roadways that are under 35 miles an hour. It only goes about 25 miles an hour. Unlike a golf cart, it actually has four doors, windows, power windows. It has air conditioning and heat. It has a real dual-channel brake system. So unlike a golf cart that if the brakes fail, they fail completely. This is a real vehicle and it passes all the DOT testing. This to me is like that small step for some of these Asian imported EVs. And this one is kind of unique. It because it falls into the small vehicle or low speed vehicle category, it bypasses a lot of these trade issues. And it's $17,995 delivered to your doorstep. They're setting up servicing and things like that. Really, really sort of an interesting idea. This guy's claim to fame was he's imported literally a billion vehicles, but they're all Happy Meals toys. So
Yeah.
he was a guy who literally imported all of the Happy Meals cars. And he said it was just very similar to this. He actually had to have special kinds of tires, special kinds of axles and things, so they met all the safety standards for toys in the United States. And he's basically taking that knowledge and doing that with this little small vehicle. And it looks like it's going to work. It's got like a 80-mile range. It'll do 25 miles an hour. You can put four people in it. It's got room for stuff in the back. I don't know. It's kind of a neat little vehicle.
And there are Chinese motorcycle manufacturers that are doing gangbusters here in the United States right now. CF Moto is doing incredible work. They're selling motorcycles, ATVs, side by sides. I think they have watercraft. They're selling everything. And it's kind of the like if you look back at the way Toyota and Honda and Nissan started selling cars in this country, their original dealers were like a guy who had a gas station. And he was able to pick up the franchise. And that's exactly the way CF Moto is really making a foothold here in the United States. And you can see how like they're offering a product that's significantly cheaper than the vehicles that we're able to purchase now, but they're great quality vehicles. And it's just providing an avenue for people who would normally be priced out of the market for something new.
We're going to go to Mark, who's calling from York. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Hi,
Yeah, I
Mark.
have a quick question about extended warranties. Well, I purchased in 23 a new Ford Maverick Hybrid, and of course, this will be my year. By December, I'm going to be at my 3-year limit, and I'm wondering, should I get extended warranty? Is that a good way to go? Or should I just try to save a little money every month and keep that in case I need repairs?
That's a great question, Mark. Which of you wants to join in, John?
Yeah, extended warranties are kind of interesting. If I had to go with an extended warranty, and AAA sells extended warranties in a lot of locations, I would definitely go with either the manufacturer, and I hate to be self-promoting, but or AAA, only because there's so many of these extended warranty companies that promise a lot and don't deliver that much. They become very difficult to deal with from a repair shop standpoint. Sometimes they'll require the parts to be purchased, the lowest price part available, which if anyone's bought any parts on the internet lately, a lot of them are just terrible. Where at least when you go with the vehicle manufacturer, you know you're getting Ford Motor Company parts, which really helps a lot. For me, I'm not a big believer in extended warranties. I know probably my bosses at work hate me saying that, but for me, I would rather tuck a little bit of money away. And is your Maverick a hybrid?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so you have a really good warranty on the hybrid drive system. So for
Nice.
me, tuck a little bit of money away every month if you think that's a good idea to keep a little emergency fund for repairs. Other than that, keep an eye on recalls, because that car has had a fair amount of recalls. But
Yes.
other than that,
I've been so yeah.
other than that,
One
just
of the things that
maintain it and deal with the factory warranty.
That's what I thought, because my last vehicle was a Ford pickup, and what I did when I stopped, when I was done making my payments, I'd make the payments to myself into a savings account, and then I'd
Perfect
use
idea.
that money to do any repairs, and then any money left I used as a down payment when I bought a new vehicle. So I may go
Well, you're
that
one of the
route too.
smartest people I know.
Yeah.
Well,
All of the
it was
hybrid.
actually a car guy from Canada. He said that's the way to do it. He said, you're already making the payment, even if you want to cut it by 20%, keep making that payment. It's already budgeted in, and then you're going to have some money to do your repairs and maybe some left over to be able to buy another car. So anyway,
Mark, that may be the best advice of the hour. Craig, what were you going to say?
To John's point, the hybrid technology in that vehicle is protected by a federal warranty. So, and that's John, what is it, 8 years, 100,000 miles, is that correct? And that's the complicated, expensive part of that vehicle. So, you're already covered there, and that's a unique hybrid system. It's a really interesting CVT in that it's gear driven, which is different than a lot of belt driven CVTs. It's derived from Toyota technology, so it's solid to begin with, but you're protected on the expensive stuff. I would keep saving the money, and I think you had the right thought.
Mark, thanks for your call. Going to go here to an email from Greg. Henry Ford is famously quoted for having said, "Any color the customer wants, as long as it's black." American roads used to be a kaleidoscope of color: vibrant reds, lemon yellow, forest green, pumpkin orange. No more. Now, with rare exceptions, it's black and white in the occasional shade of fog gray. Trucks, Secret Service black, body, grill, windows, cars, bland rental, and insurance company salesman white. What's the deal? It can't be customer choice. There is little choice. Mickey, I'm going to turn to you because Craig is, I confess,
Everybody has a thought on this one.
I drive a red car, and I am with him. What the heck is wrong with some colors?
So I agree totally. I had a red Prius before. I have my gray Prius, and I hate the color of my car, but it was good. It was good price. One of the things that happened, two things have happened. One is fleet sales. So if you think about sales to Hertz, if you think about sales to companies that will buy 100 cars a year, that sort of thing, the grays and the whites and the blacks are because of fleet sales. Fleets just want, give me 75 in gray. They don't want five blue ones and 10 yellow ones and that kind of thing. It's actually expensive to paint a car, and I've been in the paint shops in many, many factories, and the process is an expensive process, and they would just as soon have you buy, sell you the 10 gray rather than change the nozzle every single time to paint the car. And I think what's happened is as we've moved into bigger vehicles, as we've moved into pickup trucks and SUVs, which are now 80% of the market, that no, I wouldn't say nobody's buying them for appearance. Maybe they're buying them for intimidating appearance, but color has been less important as the market has shifted into SUVs and pickups.
Now, John, you just drove a Subaru that was not black, white, or gray, though, right?
No, I've driven a couple of cars lately that have not been black, white, or gray. And the color to me really does stand out. But then again, the new car I just purchased is, I think it's called Hampton Gray. And I live in a very touristy neighborhood. And I was staring out the window the other day and I'm looking and I'm like, well, I have a gray car. They have three gray cars across the street visiting. The people next door to me have a gray car. The woman down the street has a gray car. And like gray is, I think gray is the second or third most popular color right now in 2026. The car we just got rid of was yellow. And it really stood out. It stood out because it was a fun little color
When
car.
you came
And
out of the grocery store, you knew which car was yours.
exactly. It also left a pile of rust wherever it went, but there was the downside of that. But you're right. Color has become, some of the Stellantis cars have some pretty interesting colors. Kia has some pretty interesting colors. The color car that I was sort of interested in was a green, but I couldn't find one, so I went with gray. And my other Hyundai is also gray. So I guess I'm just a boring person. So.
Here's another pitch for Slate too. Like their approach to color is you can pick any color you want. It's a wrap. So the vehicle is a lot of plastic panels on it, and it's just wrapped in any color you want. And it's pretty amazing. Like you can do any, like it's outlandish the kinds of things that you can choose. And it's a little bit of an upcharge, but it's not like it's the same upcharge that you might get charged for. A Starlight Mica paint from Toyota or from Mazda or something, that's a $500 upcharge in a lot of cases. So that's the upcharge for the wrap, and then you can get it in any color you want, which I
And
really
Craig, I
appreciate.
think don't they have that wrap as a DIY wrap too? Can't you do it
Correct.
yourself?
Yeah,
Yeah.
correct.
And what's neat about Slate is, you get a Slate and then you pretty much want to go out and buy a 3D printer afterwards because you can 3D print all the accessories on the inside of the car. So it's kind of it's an interesting idea.
So many ways that everything is about to really change, but we do need to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the show Car Advice. My guest, AAA's John Paul, Boston Globe contributing columnist Mickey Maynard, and Craig Fitzgerald, automotive editor for DCI Marketing. There's time to get your question in. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. So many questions coming in by email. I'll try to get to a couple of them. Here's one from Frederick. I have a 2020 Camry with about 80,000 miles. I drive it a mix of highway and local roads. My Toyota dealer says I need a brake and transmission and power steering flush. True? How can I be sure? John, I'm sending it back to you.
Brake fluid definitely is a good idea. Brake fluid is tends to attract moisture. Moisture is the enemy of any brake system, especially anti-lock brake systems. Power steering flush is an add-on thing that, unless the fluid looks like maple syrup, I wouldn't bother with it. Transmission fluids in that model Toyota says it's good for life. It is not. It tends to break down over time, especially if you get stuck in the snow and you spin the tires up a lot, you can overheat the fluid. I'm not a big believer in totally flushing fluids, because what happens is there's a certain amount, especially with Toyota products, there's a certain amount of clutch material that actually, as it starts to break down, helps actually improve the shifting of the vehicle. So I would do a drain and refill, not a flush of the transmission fluid. Where the car is 6 years old and has 80,000 miles on it, it's not too far along to worry about anything bad happening. It's a good mileage to do it, but I would just do a drain and refill. I wouldn't do a flush. Sometimes doing a flush moves stuff around too much and can cause some problems.
Okay, an email from Ann. I just heard your guest explain that the vehicle he was able to buy for about the vehicle he was able to buy for $30,000. He implied that a hybrid at that price wasn't possible. I just brought a brand new Prius last month for $32,000. It is the basic model, but it has all the bells and whistles for safety. I'm getting between 60 and 70 miles per gallon. I did have to order it and wait for it to be shipped from Japan, which took about 6 weeks. But it is possible to get a hybrid vehicle for about $30,000 if you're patient. So to be clear, John, you were looking for an SUV, and
Prius I was looking for the difference between a Tucson and a Tucson hybrid. My lifestyle is I sort of need the storage capacity of an SUV, so that fits my needs. As great as a Prius is, and a Prius can you can put a ton of stuff in a Prius. My wife just doesn't like driving the Prius. So I think I've driven every generation of Prius, including the first one that came out that was right-hand drive that came directly from Japan. So I'm a big fan of Priuses. Just in this particular case, that Tucson hybrid was going to be about $5,000 more.
All right. Let's see. An email here from Rob. I own EVs, and while I get why many people want to own hybrids, I never did because you still have oil changes and mechanical maintenance for the fuel part of the engine, right? Craig, is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So you still have to maintain that engine just as you would, you know, any other engine. So things like timing belts and coolant hoses and all of the kind of things that are ancillary to or that make an internal combustion engine work. That's all true of the hybrid too. But it's a bridge, you know. I think there was some confusion about like how many hybrids were actually out there and how many, you know, like it took us a while to figure out how long those batteries were going to last. It took us a long time to understand how reliable these vehicles were going to be. They've proven themselves to be incredibly reliable. They're used as taxi cabs in New York City with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of miles. Abusive miles on them, and they've done completely well. So, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. There is maintenance that is required in a hybrid, but I think the payoff is that they're not that much more expensive than a traditional internal combustion engine, and it's not quite the sort of educational leap as an EV is. And I understand that. Like, I love EVs, but understanding where you're supposed to charge them and how they work and all that kind of stuff, it's a leap that a lot of people don't want to take. So we need to kind of educate people better and show them that it's an easy process, and that will start to pick up as well.
We have a few minutes left, and I want to spend that time talking about the future. We've already heard about ways that cars, the automotive industry are changing. We've already heard on the show about in China, you can swap out a battery like a piece of Lego for one that's stronger or designed for longer distances. We've heard about cars that have DIY elements with 3D printers. We've been talking about a vehicle that only goes 35 miles an hour, but is a real car. There are bigger changes afoot though, aren't there, Mickey? There are changes in the way we are going to finance and I'm going to use the word buy cars in the future. It's going to be entirely different in the pretty near future, isn't it?
I think we're headed to an inflection point because the price of a car, as you were saying earlier, is now close to 50. And I should say the reason for that is because the SUVs and the pickup trucks have boosted the price of buying a vehicle. You have people who are paying more than $1,000 a month in car payments. And if you match that against this economy, what's happening is that people in sort of middle income ranges and below are really being priced out of buying a new vehicle. Now, obviously, two out of three vehicles sold in America are used. So used car market is there. But you've got a couple things going on. You've got prices going up. You've got people's incomes being stretched. And then you've got younger people who, I live in Ann Arbor, which is a college community. And so we see a lot of this here. People who want bike lanes, people who ride their skateboards, people who want walkability, people who want public transportation. Obviously, that's true in many parts of New England. And so you've got this younger generation, from 18 to 30-ish, that doesn't own cars and isn't really interested in owning cars because their lifestyles are different. And you've got this push for more density in housing where you won't have as many parking spaces in an apartment building or a condo building. And so there's a bunch of generational things going on, income things, lifestyle things, and attitudes towards vehicles. And while we still have lots of people who love cars and SUVs and pickups, that general enthusiasm that we saw for them among American society, say, two generations ago, has kind of evaporated. And so now the car makers are trying to not only predict what kind of vehicles we will want, but whether we will want to own vehicles at all.
And if we don't own vehicles, aren't there going to be models like car clubs where you are a member and you get a certain number of hours or days a month and the car will come? You're nodding, Craig. The car will come to you when you need it.
So several of the manufacturers have kind of embarked on this thing. GM did for a little while, where you leased a Trailblazer, and oh, you know what? Over the weekend, I'd love to have a Corvette, or I'd like to try the Cadillac, and there was a kind of swap model, and it didn't work out. They just never got it off the ground. And Hyundai tried it too with it was like it was a ladder kind of a step where you went from the internal combustion. You could try the hybrid, you could try the EV version of the same vehicle. And none of these things have really gotten off the ground. And I think it's because when people actually get a hold of a car, they don't want to give it up. They sort of, it's almost like your attorney. You hate all attorneys, but you love the attorney that you have that's, gotten you through your legal issues. It's a personal vehicle, and once you've given it up, it's no longer yours. It's like a rental model, and it sort of hasn't worked up till this point. But I'm very interested to see how it works in the future if it's almost like a subscription model to a specific car. That may be something that has a lot more legs.
So we've been hearing about this pretty much my whole adult life, this whole idea of, car ownership clubs and, these prestige clubs where you can turn in your Cadillac every 6 months or whatever for a new one. But I think one of the issues that the car makers, the American car makers, let's just say, are facing is the idea of where EVs fit in and also where electrification fits in. And if you go on General Motors' website, which I did when I wrote my column for The Globe, and you read what they're saying about electrification, they're not talking about cars and trucks anymore. They're talking about going across society. And I think that has something to do with the grid as well. And we know Tesla sells home batteries as well as vehicles. And so what they're trying to do is say, we're going to participate in this, but don't just think of it as vehicles. We're going to be participating in this electrification of society. And I think that's a very interesting approach. And it kind of harkens back to the very early days of the automobile when nobody knew what role automobiles were going to play in their lives.
Yeah, I mean, think about people were using horses and buggies back then. John, we have about a minute left. Go ahead.
To take that one step further, that's where autonomous vehicles could really fit in, and especially electric autonomous vehicles, where the car goes away when you don't use it. And then when you require it, it just suddenly shows up at your house. Now, to take Craig's step a little bit further, people who like cars, who have a car, they name their car because they don't. It becomes a part of the family. So it's kind of interesting to see where it will all go in the future, especially if car prices continue to jump up the way they have been.
And You mentioned autonomous cars. A lot of people call them self-driving cars, John. A few years ago, we had lots of conversations about them, but we don't see that much going on anymore. I know that in places like Los Angeles and Phoenix and San Francisco, they are everywhere. In 15 seconds, what's your prediction of when they will be everywhere on the East Coast?
It's quietly happening, and all the technology is getting people used to taking their hands off the wheel.
They're coming to Boston, so although I bet they'll be lost in Boston, just like the rest of us.
I give it a decade before it actually we see, real traction there.
Righty. Great predictions to end the program. The voices you just heard, Craig Fitzgerald, automotive editor for DCI Marketing and former president of the New England Motor Press Association. John Paul, senior manager of public affairs and traffic safety at AAA Northeast. He is also host of the Car Doctor radio podcast. And Mickey Maynard, an author, a columnist for the Boston Globe, and she publishes Intersection, Everything That Moves on Substack. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. You can go to mainecalling.org for our audio archives and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Tomorrow on the program, what to know about squid and what researchers are learning about this fascinating marine creature. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.